Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets in the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Mr. Chad Monster Hunter Riley.
Howdy.
Howdy, hey.
I got my shotgun, I got my 10-gallon hat,
so you're pretty
and I got my spurs.
Wait, hold on. So you're a Texas Monster Hunter?
Sure. Roll with it, come on.
And also with us tonight is Spencer Williams.
I am not a Texan tonight.
I would hope. Have we ever
But every other day of the week, he sure is.
I have no idea where this conversation is going.
Good places,
but you know
guaranteed.
What? We're going to have a fun night tonight as we're going to be diving deep into the franchise that seems to be mystifying most people, and that is the Cloverfield franchise. So stick around. But before we start into this great conversation, Chad, why don't you tell a little bit about us?
Yeah, about us. In every version of reality that we know of, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. Before you find yourself on the wrong end of a particle accelerator, you should subscribe to the podcast. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, Audio Boom, Stitcher, Libsyn, and other platforms. Spencer, what can they do if they want to find us?
Well, they can not get stuck in a wall and join the Facebook conversation at facebook.com/filmlosophers.
It's like I love these life lessons from Spencer every week. Don't get stuck in a wall.
I just read the copy right now. I was wondering what he was laughing at earlier, and I'm just like, oh, yeah, that can be a little
priceless.
Comical.
Oh, also, you can join us at Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Let us know what you think of our latest reviews and other movie news. You can access the entire episode archive at filmlosophers.com.
We got a website.
Web-a-site. I've had a rough week.
I was going to say.
All of my words have just been wrong all week. This podcast is going to be a mess tonight. I just know it.
Honestly, I think this is going to be your shining moment because this is frustrated, Spencer.
It's going to be so sad. I'm not going to listen to this.
I'm excited.
I'm scared.
He's a scared. Well, after all that craziness, of course, like you said, you can catch all of our previous episodes as well as any new episodes on our website at filmlosophers.com. But like we said, we have a great show in store, and coming into this conversation that we've actually been having on the side for a little bit of time, and we decided to actually bring it here to the podcast, is the conversation of the Cloverfield franchise. So one of the greatest things a filmmaker or studio can do is create a world that goes beyond the borders of celluloid, whether that pertains to the superpowered franchises from Marvel and DC, or the macabre and creepy from Tim Burton. Creating universes within the fictional realm that feel a bit nonfiction is an incredible skill. Not many are capable, and in their attempts end up with failed projects or franchises that never garner anything more than negative critiques. Michael Bay and the Prince of
True, or the new Universal Monsters universe that is sort of like hobbling along.
No, it's canceled. It's done with.
Oh, it's fully canceled? I thought they were still going to try to do one more.
Well,
no, never mind. Godzilla, the new Godzilla doesn't fit in. That's not a Universal.
That's not a Universal.
Is that Paramount? Things that Chad should have researched before he opened his mouth.
I believe it's Legendary.
For 200. Sorry, I'm playing Jeopardy.
It's okay. So, if any film or anything can be a testament to this, it is through the tireless yet inventive work that has been put into one of the most interesting film franchises of the last decade, the Cloverfield franchise. Obviously,
which nobody knew was going to be a franchise when the first one came out.
Oh, completely.
True. Did not
like,
know.
It was a total standalone film as far as anybody knew, but then it has now become something.
Yeah, I remember when I saw 10 Cloverfield Lane come out, I was like, what is this? Well, there's a second movie?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were with you on that. Because it had been, what, 8 years?
Yeah, give or take, because...
Yeah.
When did I believe it came out in 2015.
Oh, gosh. Just imagine if there was that kind of space in the Marvel franchise.
It would not be as popular as it is.
I'd be
I'm sorry. 2016.
Yeah, the first one was 2008. The second one was 2016. So it was, 8 years between them.
Man, we're speeding along now.
Well, and then since you say the most recent one, 2018, if you were watching the Super Bowl, you happened to catch the single only trailer.
The only time they said anything was happening.
Drop during the middle of the Super Bowl at a random time, stating that Netflix was going to drop the third film tonight at that evening.
Yeah, Super Bowl Sunday night, it dropped on Netflix, which was very, I thought that was a really cool, interesting, bold marketing move, because I do marketing, you know, for my day job, and I thought it was really cool that they did that. I mean, if you're going to advertise somewhere, you might as well advertise during the Super Bowl.
True, especially if you're going to put all your eggs in one trailer basket, so to speak.
Well, and to distribute through Netflix in the first place.
Oh,
that's remarkable.
Well, and the thing is that we'll get into the whole makeup of what, you know, the third film is about. But, I mean, ultimately, the whole franchise, it's produced by J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot Productions. The franchise has, on the surface, become a successful sci-fi series that has entranced and entertained audiences worldwide. But we are not just going to talk about the surface. The entirety of the franchise has become a sort of conundrum, if you will, a kind of a puzzle for many people to actually pursue.
It is. It's like the ultimate puzzle box, which is Abrams' entire thing, right?
Yeah. So we'll take a closer look at this cinematic puzzle and dissect to the core what could be the most complex cinema piece ever created.
It's not a franchise in the same sense as like a Marvel or a Star Wars, you know, or anything, or even I think to a certain extent the alleged, you know, Pixarverse where everything is interconnected. I mean, this one, the Cloverfield verse, is apparently interconnected, but all very independent, and potentially from entirely different timelines.
Yeah. So just to get a couple of logistical aspects of these films. The films are directed by, in you know, sequential order, Matt Reeves, Dan Trachtenberg, Julius Onak, and the last film, which will be debuting towards the end of this year, Overlord, is directed by Julius Avery.
Two films in 1 year
that's
for
crazy.
The same franchise.
Yeah.
That's
so
remarkable.
Crazy. Even though Marvel does three.
Well, true. Point taken.
The Cloverfield franchise actually stars several fantastic performers, such as Michael Stahl, David, Odette, Annabelle, T.J. Miller, John Goodman, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, David Oyelowo, Elizabeth Debicki, Daniel Brühl, Zhang Ji, and many others. This franchise has pretty much blossomed into this.
And my favorite, Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
He's actually.
I don't know
been
if
saying-
I've been practicing that name, and I'm probably not pronouncing it right. But number one, she was phenomenal in this movie.
No doubt.
In the Paradox film, the third one, but also. She totally carries the movie, basically. So I've been practicing her name to make sure I get it partially
right.
He's
been saying her name all day.
I love that name. It's so cool.
Yeah, it's a cool name.
It's a cool name. Come on now.
Cloverfield is an American science fiction horror anthology film series and media franchise.
Wait, could you say that again? American?
American science fiction horror anthology film series.
What other franchise could say something like that? Like so many descriptors that are all accurate.
Maybe if
that's remarkable,
the filmmaker was Mexican.
I'm just gonna sit back and admire for a minute. All right, I'm done. Thank you for waiting with me.
So this film, like I said, is an American science fiction horror anthology film series and media franchise created and produced by J.J. Abrams, consisting of four films, viral marketing websites linking the films together, and a tie-in manga to the first film titled Cloverfield Kishin, which debuted in 2008, and it is set in a shared fictional universe referred to as the Cloververse. So we're going to kind of talk about not just because the most recent one that dropped was Cloverfield Paradox, and we're gonna go through and we're gonna talk about that one a bit. But I think the bigger elephant in the room is what this entire franchise kind of has in terms of impact for cinematic universes and how it's created something so substantial and unique. That you were hitting on it a little bit ago, Chad.
Yeah.
That from a marketing standpoint, it's practically pure genius. It's the only one that's doing these types of things.
Yeah, it operates totally differently than any other franchise that you would know about. I mean, that you would have followed. The fact that they waited so long between the first and the second one.
Yeah.
I don't, like, did they just decide 6 years in, oh, you know what, we should try to continue this and do something else that connects to it. Like, I it would be interesting to see, because the films are not the only things that are necessarily connected in terms of J.J. Abrams' properties. Eddie, you and I were just watching a video on YouTube that was connecting some of the Easter egg elements to many of his TV shows that he created and produced. You know, some of them he was showrunner on, and others he was just getting the money. You know, but it's interesting because this level of storytelling isn't really bound to, it's not bound to one universe, one timeline, one set of like physical conditions or physics. I mean, it definitely is pretty broad and expansive, especially after the most recent film, The Cloverfield Paradox. So it really explains things, but it also opens up more possibilities than most of us probably thought were, you know, in the card deck, if you will.
True.
I was gonna mention.
Go ahead, go for it.
They've always had like a really weird marketing style, because like, I don't know if you remember, like, back when the first movie came out, like the trailers for that one just showed a bunch of shaky cam footage and then no title for what the heck you just saw.
Right, I do remember that.
A date.
There was only a date,
and yep. I was like, "This is crazy," but I actually followed it and was actually hyped for the movie, so they must know something about marketing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have somebody like J.J. Abrams who has created interesting properties, like Chad was saying, with Alias, with Lost, with, you know, stuff like from Super 8 to even interesting aspects of like the Star
even
Trek
the
universe.
Star Trek reboot, yeah.
Right. And you have somebody who has...
Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first of the new trilogy.
Yeah.
So you have somebody who's extremely experienced when it comes to creating or working in current cinematic universes. And now with everything he's done aside from the bigger franchises, you know, you have a created universe that has pretty much been running through like a thread through all of his personal properties.
Right.
And coming to fruition with what we're seeing in Cloverfield as like, oh, okay, yeah, that was in this series. Okay, that was mentioned in this series. That was mentioned in that series. And we're going to take a look at a lot of that and kind of see what it is that he's trying to do, exactly what these films are probably going to achieve, and where we stand in terms of how genius or how ridiculous this type of marketing is. So,
yeah, because it certainly isn't for everyone.
No, and unless you're either super, like, super invested, or you're just somebody who has way too much time on your hands, there's a lot of stuff to sift through when it comes to these types of movies.
Sure.
In terms of information and websites and Twitter handles and faux social pages.
Or you can be like me and just watch YouTube videos that other people who already research that stuff put together for you.
So let's go back.
It's like Cliff Notes.
True. It is like Cliff Notes. So let's go back to 2008 and... Spencer, close your eyes, if you will. We're going back to a little bit of chimes. No, let's go back to 2008. And if you guys, I don't know if you guys went to the theater to actually see it.
I did.
I actually did as well.
I did not.
Well, Spencer.
I have seen it. I have seen it, but I did not see it in the theater.
So then prior to coming into seeing the first film, and same mindset with you, what were your thoughts in terms of, with the limited amount of promotional materials, the poster that was very vague, looked like a ripoff to the Day After Tomorrow poster.
Yep, it sure did.
You know, there was a lot of things that were, me personally, running through my mind. But let's start with you, Spencer. What was actually going into your mind before you went into the first Cloverfield?
The first Cloverfield. Oh, that was 10 years ago. That's so sad. Okay. Yeah, anyway. The first Cloverfield, like, no, I was just very confused. I'm like, who doesn't have a title at the end of the trailer? Like, what's going on? And I just was like eyeing it the whole time, waiting for it to come out, and then it came out, and then I saw it, and then I was like, oh, this is different.
Very profound.
I'm blown away by your
I'm glad I could do that.
I mean, for me,
with the eye roll and everything, I'm glad I could do that.
For me, it was a moment of just wondering when the next great piece of science fiction was going to come about. We hadn't really had anything grand come into play. And this was around the time when Paranormal Activity was big. You had a lot of the shaky cam horror films.
Oh my gosh.
I believe Paranormal Activity debuted in 2007. So with that, you had the consecutive works of, you know, people trying to do that similar motion with horror films.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came to what we were watching in the little bit of a promotional material that they gave out, or that they, you know, shot out for Cloverfield, it was kind of, it was one of those places where you're like, ah, you know what? This just looks like everybody else. It looks like everything else. When did Paranormal Activity come out? I know you're looking it up.
I was not actually.
Oh, you're fired.
I was looking at something else.
But so for me, I've been wanting to see a great science fiction film. There had been talks at the time that somebody was going to either do a reboot of Alien or somebody was going to do a continuation of Alien. We had just lost a dear friend in Firefly. And so fiction was kind of just the push to the side child. It was put on the back burner. So when this debuted, you didn't really have an understanding of what this movie was about. In fact,
well, a lot of people thought it was a Godzilla reboot.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, you knew that you knew it was a creature feature.
Right.
At least.
I think, you know, you didn't have a title for the movie, but you knew it was a creature feature, and everybody thought it was yet another reboot of Godzilla. And it wasn't, but it felt like a Godzilla movie at the same time.
Oh, completely, because of the destruction of the Statue of Liberty that was in the poster, mm-hmm. you know, the chaos that was going on in the city. It looked like spot on parallel to any monster flick that you've seen.
Definitely.
Which is the key thing for me, is it's something, in my mind, it was something that you had already seen. So I wasn't really in the mood for another Matthew Broderick Godzilla. And
I don't think anybody was. That movie underwhelmed most everyone.
Oh my gosh, that movie was so hilariously terrible.
But I mean, come on. After that film, it was really difficult to trust any sci-fi or monster flick that was going to be offered to the masses. And I, for one, was skeptical of what it could be.
I think that there was definitely, it kind of had that interesting mashup of, like, you know, like a Godzilla or a King Kong or some sort of a creature flick with that Blair Witch Project, Paranormal Activity, yeah, kind of shaky cam, you know, found footage genre. And I think that more than anything is what got people into the theaters, you know, was thinking, okay, if number one, if I take my Dramamine before going in and can handle the shaky footage, like if this continues the entire time and you never break out of the found footage feeling and into like the omniscient camera that oversees everything, then that makes for a very unique perspective,
yeah,
on a creature feature. And thankfully that's what they stuck with. It was all, I believe, minus a little bit of like television broadcast kind of footage that still you're viewing through the camera,
yeah,
you know, but it's all found footage. You never really break into, and now we're just going to hover over everything. It's extremely rare that you even get wide shots in the film. Everything
True.
Is very claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Because you don't, as the viewer, you don't know what's going on because the camera isn't looking in the direction that you want to look.
It's very much so like in your, like, in the situation point of view, because it's different to have like a first person, because then you're somebody who's being focused in certain directions, and you're being led by the focus of the film. And then you have,
sure,
that outside perspective of, you know, you being pretty much an unmanned force of viewability when it comes to watching the film. You're at the whim of whoever is holding you. You're at the whim of whoever's controlling the camera in the film itself.
Well, and yeah, because different characters pick up the camera at,
exactly,
different points in time.
Yeah. And you, and I guess this kind of jumps into the film a little bit, but with that mindset, you know, once the camera gets handed off, it's like you see what is the focus for each one of those people. Who are they focusing on? What,
yeah,
are they focusing on? And I think that's a very interesting aspect that J.J. Abrams alone. So let's just get this out of the way. J.J. Abrams is a genius. I personally think the man has a lot of... Either he has a huge writing staff and a large amount of time to just think up stuff like this. It's incredible with the things that he's had a hand in.
Now, here's the thing that really interested me, because I did a little digging of my own. I know you're both shocked. I'm shocked. I can't believe I actually did research before a show. I think that there's a good amount of credit that probably also goes to Matt Reeves, who
who
has not only did he direct the first Cloverfield film, he has a history with J.J. Abrams that goes all the way back to Felicity, which is the first TV show that Abrams was showrunner on, and Matt Reeves was writer and director on several of the episodes for that show. So I think they must have a rapport. And just seeing some of the other things that Matt Reeves has done over the years, because he also did, as director, he did War for the Planet of the Apes, which was the most recent one. And he also was writing on that one. He did a few other projects. He's in pre-production still on The Batman, which may or may not ever happen with Ben Affleck. And, you know, so just given some of the other pieces in his filmography, yeah. I think that he probably had a pretty good hand in the shaping of the original Cloverfield as well.
No doubt. And he's actually
both as writer and director.
He was also the director of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes as well. So
he was, yeah.
But it's interesting. I've never noticed this, and probably because I haven't reflected back on this film, but I don't know if either of you, it's a horror movie, so maybe not, but I don't know if either of you have seen the movie called Let Me In. It was one of Chloe,
unfortunately.
What's her name? Chloe Moretz Grace?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was one of her first films coming into it. It's a very interesting film that the gist of the film is this bullied young boy becomes friends with a little girl who happens to be a vampire, and she kind of helps him understand how to be a little bit more confident in himself, but at the same time also eliminates a lot of the bullies that bug him and stuff like that. It's a really interesting movie. There's a lot more to it than I'm giving off of, but to know that Matt Reeves is the man who orchestrated that kind of throughway for that, because it's based off of...
Yeah, he wrote and directed that one as well.
Yeah, which it's based off of a Danish film, I believe, but having somebody like Matt Reeves to be able to translate that well enough to where it doesn't drift away from the original source material so much, but it still stands on its own. I think that's actually pretty unique. So I got to give Matt Reeves, you're right, I got to give Matt Reeves more credit than...
Yeah, I think definitely you've got the science fiction puzzle box elements that are very J.J. Abrams, but I think that darker tone and the building up of tension in the audience, mm-hmm. that might be more Matt Reeves, at least for the first one. Obviously, he didn't direct the other two that we've seen, or the fourth one.
And that's kind of where, you know, when you get into the second one, we'll talk about that. But I think the focus of the second one and the focus and the tension buildup is a little different. It's not so much as like a moment of terror and whatnot, but this film builds and builds on its tension. Spencer, you've seen the second one as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can agree on that in terms of the difference between the first film and the second film. The first film, there's a lot of movement. There's a lot of action. It seems like everything is fluid. Everything is constant. Everything is just like a moving picture all the time.
Yeah. The second one is much more like cerebral and like, you know, oh, there's a possible threat from this guy who may or may not have saved me / kidnapped me.
It's true.
A twist.
Yeah. Because so
played by the incomparable John Goodman,
right?
He literally is a fantastic performer.
Oh, he did a great job.
In this one, he's really like, a creep, like not a creep in like the weirdo kind of
he
like
literally is a creep.
He is, because in this one he weirds you out. He always is looking at Elizabeth Winstead funny. He's always making off comments. He's like, you can tell he was the outcast of the social groups he was in, mm-hmm. and in this kind of setting he is in charge, or he's placed himself in charge, and it's
he
very
has
much
power for once.
Exactly, and in this case it's very much an obvious, you know, scenario. So, but going back to the first one, one of the great things I think the first one really does is it does a great job of allowing you to really feel the threat and the concern that everyone else is feeling, because at the time, not a lot of well-known actors, not a lot of well-known actresses in 2008.
Right.
But you had people...
No, it put several of them on the map.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, no doubt. And you look at a lot of their performances, and they were phenomenal. Like, there was a little bit of time where I was wondering... Obviously, it was a fake movie. It was a movie, but it looked realistic. Like, it looked like real people going through...
And that's what they wanted.
Life. Yeah.
Sorry, that was my entire thing. You're looking at me like I'm going to say something else. But
sorry.
They wanted it to feel like real people, not like, you know, famous faces.
Yeah, and I think choosing people who were not as well known was the prime point for casting in this particular film, because you still wanted great performers, but I think having people who were like well known, like if there was a Bradley Cooper at the forefront, or if there was a, you know, a Brad Pitt or a whomever, anybody who was head at the time of the, you know, actors and actresses well known,
sure,
you know, the face among faces, mm-hmm. I think that would have taken away a lot of what the film was trying to bring focus to, which was there was a threat literally looming overhead, and we need to run for our lives to get to a place where we can be safe.
Right. I mean, it definitely had that whole like, oh, wow, what would I do if that was happening? Mm-hmm. Like, what would I do if aliens were invading, if there was a monster from down below the earth that was coming up to eat me? Like, you see these things in movies all the time. But I think some of it is like having that omniscient perspective or pseudo omniscient perspective. Mm-hmm. It takes you out of that in the moment, like heart pounding adrenaline rush experience. And Cloverfield, the first one, really put you in the moment and kept you there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're constantly being redirected. Like, you can't go over that bridge anymore because it's not there. or, you know, like going underground and coming back above ground. And then there's a quarantine center and people are exploding and all kinds of things going on.
Yeah.
That you're as confused as the main characters are. And you are just as much like, think on your feet. Like, what are you going to do, character? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
You know, it's really intense.
And going back to the choice of how they film this, you're as a, you know, outside perspective, having the outside perspective, you are literally at the whim of how well this camera can focus and how well it doesn't focus, how well this camera is looking in this angle and it allows so much light in, how much this camera is still adjusting to the light, you know, or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
And or even in the minute where, like, so one of the creepiest scenes in the first film, and I love it, as creepy as it is, I love watching it every time I get a chance, is that underground scene.
Yeah.
Where they're like
subway tunnel.
It's like, oh my gosh, it's like super dark and it's pitch black, and they're like, oh wait, you have the
night vision function on the camera.
And they turn it on and there's all these little creatures all over the place, and it is like, it is,
but the
such
characters
great...
can't see them.
Exactly.
But you can see them through the camera.
Exactly. Not only you, but the person who's handling the camera, they are like in fear and in shock. And you're like, what are they going to do now? And it's only a secret that you and the person who's holding the camera know. And you have to see how they're going to convey that bit of information to the people who are already scared out of their minds in the moment.
That reminds me, I need to buy a night vision scope stat. Like, I just need to own one. I need to.
I remember seeing that in the theater and them talking.
Such
it's like,
a great
oh, scene. There's a night vision mode. I'm like, don't turn that on. That's not going to be helpful right now. Like, and then,
that was such a great scene, though.
It was good.
I mean, it was so good.
Ah, gosh. Yeah, no, it was good.
But. I mean, you look back, and we're going to kind of deviate just a teensy bit. But you look back, and there hasn't been many scenes in cinema that have been able to pull that off, aside from 1993's Silence of the Lambs. 93,
92? Ish.
It's early 90s. Either way, that film, they have a really great final scene where the main character is in a basement of sorts, and all the lights go out, and the main antagonist has a night vision scope, and you see everything through his vision as he's like trying to pursue her, and then he's almost like he's toying with her. And that was done really well. I have to say, I think this one is almost as good in just in terms of like creating that fear and that dread, even if it's for an instant moment of like, oh my gosh, there's all these things, let's run, or that kind of stuff. It's still like the fear of, I don't know if I want to know what's in the darkness. And
then, well, and then like you said, similar to the character holding the camera at the time.
Yeah.
I'm the only one who knows. My friends in this tunnel don't know. They're exactly. about to die. All of us are about to die.
Such a great movie. Chad, did you have any like shining moments in the film that you...
I think that overall the approach was what really stuck out to me, because I prefer not to feel claustrophobic all the time. I prefer to feel like I have a broad awareness of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're going to twist things on me and surprise me, like just the visual scale of this film was so limited, but not in a, I don't mean that in a negative way. Like, it was limiting your perspective as a viewer.
Yeah.
You didn't get to know very much more than the characters, if you ever did. And I thought that was pretty ingenious. Not many films try to do that. And I thought it was well done. It was a little dizzying at times, because that camera does shake quite a bit in many, many different scenes. But there were definitely moments in the movie I recall where I thought, I have had nightmares that look like this.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. Like, this is something about the looking through a handycam nature of the entire film really felt like watching a nightmare becoming real.
Yeah.
Which I imagine if we ever did have a giant monster terrorizing New York City or a different city,
AKA
or
Spencer
aliens
Williams.
Invading, I think a lot of people would probably have that feeling of like, it. I feel like I'm trapped in a nightmare and I want to wake up. And I think that something about the format of the film did that for me, which I appreciated.
What about you, Spence? Anything that stuck out to you, or any scene that really stuck out from the first film?
Okay, so for the first film, the shaking, for camera shaking, normally I'm like, I have an iron stomach, this isn't gonna bother me, but like halfway through this movie, I'm like, oh, can we stop with this scene, because I don't feel like I can take much more.
I need a break. Pause the movie, I need a break.
This iron stomach is about to work in reverse.
Yeah, there's a few, like one part where it was pretty bad, but the rest of it was, you know, handleable. But like, I think the scene that stuck with me, still sticks with me as being, what is this supposed to mean? Is like the end scene where they like hop back like a few months, you see something splash in the ocean.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, what was that? Like, I was really confused at the time. So of course I had to go online.
And little did we know that there may be a connection all the way now in 2018.
True. Yeah.
Oh gosh,
it's true, and I guess before we get into that, just to kind of touch a bit on the second one. Obviously, the second one is a little bit more.
There was a second one.
There was a second one.
10 Cloverfield Lane,
which it wasn't a footage type of film. It was a filmed film that had a little.
Well,
bit
honestly,
more polish
they got
to
a
it.
Lot of flack about the found footage. There were quite a few people who did leave the theater and throw up. After that first, or during the first one.
Understandable.
AKA Spencer.
No, I didn't throw up, but a very understandable complaint.
The second one, like Spencer actually mentioned earlier, it was a little bit more cerebral. You were under the assumption this girl gets kidnapped at a gas station. She is taken to an underground bunker with John Goodman and another character, and there they are told that they are there because they were saved from the toxic gases and fumes and whatnot that were outside because of the monsters. So at this time, it's already established that there are monsters currently roaming the Earth.
Well, that's what he says, but
that's what he says.
But they don't know that for
allegedly.
A fact. Allegedly, alleged monsters.
What me and Chad had actually found out earlier is that during the time before she gets kidnapped, the one consistent thing that actually goes through all three films. That is currently happening that she is aware of is that there are rolling blackouts in the nearby cities. Mm-hmm. So the events that follow is this cerebral game where she's trying to figure out if John Goodman's character is actually nuts or if he's actually sane. Can she get out? Why can't she get out? Why is he making her stay there? And so forth. It's a really great film. It really does play on the more of the mind games and the aspect of, you know, how do you trick somebody who has already maybe possibly lost their mind? So this film, like Spencer said, it's a little bit more deeper. It's a little bit more on that scale. So you're not worried about like crazy shaky cam. There's not like some crazy dropping of the camera, picking up people exploding. Although there is a pretty horrendous scene of John Goodman dissolving somebody in acid. And that was very unique. That was a really interesting scene. Like, just a random scene, too.
I can see Spencer reliving it in his mind. Like, his facial expression right now. He's like, watching
I wasn't
it.
Expecting it. I was like, all of a sudden, this person is on. I'm like, oh.
As I'm talking, Spencer's eyes are getting larger and larger and larger. But ultimately, and if you haven't seen the film, shame on you. It's already been 2 years. But ultimately, at the end, she does escape. She leaves the underground bunker to find that there are monsters out there, and she is able to run away from the monsters in a vehicle and comes to find out that there is stuff happening in the nearby city, and so she decides to drive towards the city to help out instead of running away. So that's how the second film ends. And like I said, even though this film is a part of the franchise, the bigger stepping stone, I guess, if you will, of these three films was the first one, which is why we spent so much time on it. The second film establishes another point in this story verse, if we want to say the Cloverfield verse. The third film, which is the one that debuted this past
Super Bowl.
I almost said 4th of July.
It's very patriotic. It's 4th of July. I mean, it's very patriotic, the Super Bowl.
Is
very American.
This one is a very interesting film. And Chad, why don't you kind of explain a little bit about what the whole premise of this film is?
Sure. So like you were just mentioning, the film actually starts with a rolling blackout situation. You've got a husband and wife in a car. The wife is played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw. I just really like that name. And so they're waiting in line for to get gas at a gas station. Then there's a rolling blackout. They're going to have to wait longer, et cetera, whatever. You learn that she has an opportunity to go up to a space station and participate in a scientific attempt at creating limitless renewable energy with a particle accelerator.
Because at the time, it looks like their energy resources are depleting, because there's a little bit of a snippet where if you look at the gas at the time, where they're all waiting to get in line, gas is at $30 a gallon.
Oh, right. I missed that.
Yeah.
Well, because, I mean, honestly, even beyond gas, I mean, just creating electricity or whatever, it all at some level, it takes raw material.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, oh, you snap your fingers and suddenly there's a light bulb that turns on. Like, it's not, it feels very, we're disconnected from some of the raw level of power creation and generation, but it's not a magic process. It feels like magic when you just flip the switch and everything turns on, but that's not the full reality. And so, you know, they're looking at a resource shortage. There's a certain level at which you think, well, is that a version of our own world as we, you know, deal with other types of materials, shortfalls and worry about that in our own future.
True.
These characters are doing it now. Anyway, she decides to go up to the space station, where they are testing a particle accelerator. There are a few failed attempts, and then there's a successful attempt that messes with space-time to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew has an international flavor to it. I mean, you've got characters who are from different nations all working together on board this space station to create energy, basically.
Yeah. The whole purpose of them being in space, like Chad said, is to test out this large it's ultimately, like you said, it's a
particle accelerator.
Particle accelerator, that's right.
It's like a Hadron Collider, but in space.
Exactly.
In space.
And it's interesting how this film transpires. So ultimately, one of the key conversation pieces that has always circulated about these films is the one topic that's at the heart of all of them is when do these events take place?
Right. Yeah.
And it's always been difficult to nail that down because the first film takes place in 2008. The film actually states it takes place in 2008.
Right.
But then the events in 2016 happen at a much later date. And now the events that are happening in this film take place in 2028.
Right.
And so one of the concepts that has always floated around is, well, what if it's parallel universes? Which isn't a far-fetched idea for J.J. Abrams, as he's worked in parallel universes with other franchises. So what this film does, Cloverfield Paradox, it actually solidifies the fact that the films operate either in a parallel universe or in a world where parallel universes can be accessed.
Yeah, this is the first time that you actually go to a parallel universe. Mm-hmm. Because the characters that are on board this space station, what they see, what they initially think has happened is as soon as they have their first successful activation of this particle accelerator matrix, and then it fritzes out for some reason, what they think happens is that the Earth disappears.
Yeah.
They like zapped the Earth away. And then they, over the course of a few minutes of the film, realize that they didn't zap the Earth away, they moved themselves. That the station itself is somewhere other than in orbit around Earth. And as they unravel where they are and how they came to be there, they end up discovering that they zapped themselves into a parallel universe.
Mm-hmm. True. And that's
spoiler alert.
No,
sorry, I should have said that.
And so, like I said, this is where one of the most obvious theories, if you will, about the film franchise is finally validated. And that is how much of the films take place in what universe. And now we can truly say that it more than likely takes place in three different universes. Because you can look at where the first one starts, 2008, but the events over here start in 2028, but then the events over here take place in 2016, I believe. I'm not too sure when the 10 Cloverfield Lane takes place. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Takes place in... Doesn't say. But it's... the film, obviously...
I feel kind of validated that I'm not the only one who opened my mouth in this episode without doing the proper research.
Chad, you know I wouldn't let you swim alone. Come on.
Thank you, Eddie.
Spencer. Don't look at me.
I know. I'm like, we're both looking at Spencer because we're like, okay, Spencer, surely we just vamped for enough time that you found the answer, right?
No.
No. But you're right, though, Eddie. This at least establishes that they don't necessarily have to, any of them exist in the same timeline or the same exact universe.
Yeah.
That's the major, I guess, architectural takeaway. If you're looking at the architecture of this franchise, none of them have to exist in the exact same version of the universe, if you will.
And I think that's a very... Okay, one of the things that people can look at this and say is, well, that's just from an unappreciated standpoint, you can say, well, that's just lazy story writing. That's just, oh, well, you can easily say that this is over here, and then that's over there, and that's over there, and just, okay, then you could say that the next one's going to take place in 2069, and it could be a totally different story. But there's a thread of intelligence that runs through these films that if you're not watching and if you're not observant, you're going to miss out on all the key things that allow all of these films to be connected. Even though they take place in three different universes, there are several threads that run through these films in the films and outside that connect all these films together. And,
sure.
And it all boils down to the event that occurs in Cloverfield Paradox.
Which, if you are really trying to track with the idea that there are multiple, like almost infinite parallel universes where different inputs create opposing outputs or whatever, that means that this is not the only version of reality where a crew went on board a space station and activated this particle accelerator and broke space-time. That means that there are untold bazillions of universes where a crew went and did something similar, mm-hmm. to greater or lesser effect.
Yeah.
So really, I mean, it's sort of like watching, it reminds me almost mentally of the scene in The Lost World Jurassic Park where Julianne Moore is on the window as it's cracking.
Yeah.
And you're waiting for it to fall through. And if anybody's going to catch her before she falls down into the ravine, you know, with all the glass.
Yeah.
And it's like that. Like this is one self-contained story. But if you follow the logic of the universe that it's set in, that means that any number of crews in any number of realities did that. And that's that spider web fracturing of, let's say, the entire multiverse, which is something you typically only see in science fiction or in like comic book universes. But they're pulling it off in a movie universe that seems to have a lot of parallels to our own world. And it feels a lot closer to reality in certain ways, even though, yes, there are monsters. You know, yes, there are space stations that zap themselves into other universes and whatever. But but in terms of the state of the world itself, feels very uncomfortably familiar, I would say.
No, it's true. And I think that's one of the subtle geniuses about these films is that on the surface, and we mentioned this earlier, it is an incredible science fiction film. It's really well done. Each film has a certain flavor to it for a certain audience, but it all serves the same purpose. And as a science fiction fan, you can find enjoyment in that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
As a fan of cinema, as somebody who looks deeper, such as the film Lossifers,
that's what we're here for.
Exactly. You find a lot more of the subtle context, the underlying implications that it's stating about not only the state, like Chad said, not only the state of our nation, but the state of the world and how we utilize, you know, our resources, or how to what abuse we utilize our resources, or how we treat the world itself, or how we can, you know, look towards like consumerism or even capitalism to an extent. I mean, there's so much that can be unfolded and unveiled with these films that it's really genius.
Well, and you've got obviously at the heart of it too, you know, how do you define, like, who is the bad guy of the story? Who is the real monster? You know, is the monster or are we the monster? And I think a lot of great think pieces, be they science fiction or just a good story that has no fantastical elements, to have that kind of societal or even independent, like individual level of self-reflection, I think that's really interesting. That's very compelling to see. Because in this film, The Cloverfield Paradox, not only do they make a decision to try this technology without knowing what it would do, and you do have a bit of a, there's like a little
interview,
almost like a cut scene in a way, but yeah, it's an interview broadcast from Earth that the scientists on board the station see, from a guy played by Donald Logue. Donald Logue plays somebody who may be related to John Goodman's character in 10 Cloverfield Lane, by the way. They have the same last name. So they may be related, and he's saying essentially, this is about to break everything. You're being irresponsible, and you have no idea the kind of chaos that could be unleashed if these scientists up in space are successful.
Yeah.
And they go ahead and try it anyway, and chaos is unleashed. We have what seems to be at first like a monster in the walls of the station. You open the panel, and it turns out to be a human being, hence Spencer's brilliant life lesson at the beginning of this episode: don't get stuck in a wall.
Yeah, okay, about that woman in the wall, though. Like, the sound she was making did not sound like someone even in pain. It sounded like a freaking monster. And did that wall and it was a woman, I was like, what? Like, that's like...
But were you disappointed? Did you want it to be a monster?
I thought a monster was going to come out, and she's just like, help! And instead of like... Aurora! That's like the sound that it made. And
Aurora?
Like, yeah.
I mean, it was. Scooby-Doo was, like...
Scooby-Doo was stuck in the walls. Robbie!
Oh, boy. Leave it to you, Eddie.
Raggy.
And now we've brought it back to Hanna-Barbera land.
But I think that's one of the smart things this film does, is you expect, after the last two films, you expect a monster to be at every corner.
You do. You do. Absolutely.
And I'm in the same boat as Chad. When I was watching it, when we were watching it, I was expecting, like, oh my gosh, like I was tensing up in my seat and I was expecting something horrific. And in fact, it was something horrific, not in the mindset I was thinking. I was prepared for some type of monster, horrific-looking, tentacle-wearing, you know, 20-eyed creature, and yet there was somebody in pain. Now, here's the question. Am I wrong for having a sense of disappointment in wondering, okay, well, it's just a woman trapped in a wall who's got pipes through her, rather than it being an actual monster having dread and fear for that? And I think that's one of the things that this film does is it makes you aware in terms of just the type of people that we are and the type of people that go to the theaters and the type of people who are accustomed to horror films and science fiction films. Have we become to a certain extent desensitized to the actual horrors of the world today? And I think that's a great scene that really exemplifies that.
For sure. I think that I think that you are wrong for being that way. To answer your question.
Rory.
But I'm wrong too then, because I was kind of not gleefully, but I was eagerly anticipating the reveal of our first monster. And it turned out to be a human being who was like horrifically entangled in the wall. Like they get her out of it. And she makes a remarkable recovery, by the way. Like
very fast.
The state that you find her in versus like how quickly she heals or like that. That's never addressed.
Woman
but
had pipes through her body.
Like, part of the... And power conduits and things, like coursing through her muscles and skin and everything. Go ahead,
sir. Part of the medical equipment that they have on board, like, it mentions, like, cellular regeneration or something like that.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, so they're a bit more advanced than we are. So I'm guessing
that's
how...
Well, it is 2028.
So. Yeah, but, like, 10 years from now, I don't feel like...
Hey,
our healthcare system is going to advance that much.
Healthcare? I'm just hoping the pizza gets here a lot sooner, so...
Amen to that.
But I think it's a really interesting aspect, because you mentioned that and you brought it up, but in the most blatant forms of stating, like, yeah, you're wrong. We as the filmmakers, we're not wrong in this part in terms of how we switched it around. You're the one who has the wrong thinking, and it was like a... Boom, you know, like
well,
a slap in my face.
Not only the reveal, but in the moments before the reveal, right? It's all about building tension. How do you make people uncomfortable? And some of the crew members are saying, we've got to open this panel. And others are saying, heck no, that sound, I'm not opening this panel. If I was on board that space station, I would be in the heck no crowd.
Oh, I'd be on the heck yes crowd. Something is behind that panel and there's electrical stuff. That's going to start fire.
Listen, Spencer.
In space?
Just because you got muscles doesn't mean the rest of us can defend ourselves in space. There's not much else you can use. So.
But see, if they went with my version, possibly the woman would have died in the wall.
This is true.
And if they went with your version of
bravery, you would have killed the thing in the wall before you even looked at it.
Well, that's true. She would have died anyway.
What?
Just go with it.
I don't think so. That sounds weird.
No, but I mean, she's the key. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, she's the key for them to understand that they have ended up in a parallel universe. Because when they learn more of her story, and this is the character played by Elizabeth Debicki, when they learn more of her story, she's on board the station. In her reality, she was on the station, and one of the characters from, let's call it the prime reality, the main version that we saw in the beginning of the movie, that character in this reality was not on board the station.
No,
two of the characters, in fact, were not on board the station. And so she's got a level of confusion. Our main characters have a level of confusion. We're sort of starting to... at the very least say, oh, that guy in the interview was right. I mean, at the very least, that's where we are. And then additional events transpire. And really, human motivation takes over.
Oh, completely. And one of the things that is never stated in this entire film are the newcomers, if you will, on Earth. You know of war and you know of issues that are going on over the energy crisis, But during the entire time, you are unaware that anything has surfaced or anything has come about or anything is attacking. The only thing that you know of that's causing destruction are the warplanes that are going overhead and causing damage. The film doesn't mention it until the end.
Well, no, what about that one scene?
There's something in the smoke.
Yeah.
You see the silhouette in the smoke at one point.
There it is.
Oh yeah, like that?
But
yeah.
then you don't know which version of Earth you're viewing. Like which version are you looking at, and is it a version that already had these things and they know what they are? Or are they a la the first Cloverfield film? Or is this their first experience with a creature of this sort?
True.
So there's a lot of, for all of the insight that this movie does give into the why, if you will, there's still a lot of open-ended questions that are not answered by the end of this film.
Yeah, there's quite a few, even in this film, that I still have a few problems with.
Well, and so that's funny that you say in
the
film.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Spencer, you're a genius. I thought this movie answered everything within it. No, I didn't. But tell me more.
Well, okay. Like, I guess my problem is that I don't feel like I understand what some of the science or the physics of that this movie is trying to set up actually is. Because there's some things that happen on the space station, like, you know, like this woman in the wall, like, I have a feeling I know what happened to her, but I don't know for a fact what happened to
her. Sure.
Also, this guy who happens to lose an arm in a rather unsettling sequence.
Right.
Like, why did the wall attack him? Like, what realm of science does that?
In the mindset of paradoxes, there is a universal law that in the presence, theoretically, in the presence of a paradox, the universe will correct itself to fit the paradox, to correct the paradox. So whenever there's an instance where there is a you know, something that is not supposed to be there, say the current timeline or the current universe has certain individuals who have passed or who have died, because they've died and now there's people who are them in that universe again, the universe will remove them in certain instances to correct the paradox that is currently in place.
Okay, but generally, when you deal with like multiple universes, a universe isn't trying to like do a final destination on anyone who crosses into that universe who happens to be of a copy of a person.
The extent of my knowledge here is based off of Futurama, so I don't know much.
And I'm basing mine off of sliders, and they could just slide into all these universes, and they were perfectly fine no matter what happened to their counterpart. So that's weird. And that's why you kind of need to set that kind of stuff up, because true, based on what other people know, that could be super confusing. Well,
and they do mention it in the film that there is an unknown factor in terms of how the current laws of physics work within the paradox. That's one thing that Daniel Brühl's character states several times, is that within the paradox, the rules are different. They're changed, and we don't know how they're operating. So we just need to be aware and be mindful. So it is stated that it's not planning to explain any of that. Like, it states at the very beginning of the whole chaos in that, yes, things are changed and stuff is happening and we can't explain it right now and there may be a possibility of paying this off later, but not likely. That's what I got out of that scene.
Yeah, I did too, but I was unhappy with that answer.
Ultimately, it's sort of like the, you know, classical Greek myth of Pandora's box. That's essentially what this is. It's a retelling of Pandora's box. They've opened the box now. And you have no way of saying what's going to come out of the box. What's in the box?
What's in the box?
You have no idea there's no concept of when or how reality is going to change now that you've opened the box.
Yeah. And speaking of opening the box, was there any other
thing? Nah, I'm just thinking about it now.
Spencer is lost in thought right now, and he's going to write a strongly worded email to J.J. Abrams.
Sending all sorts of people emails based on this podcast.
speaking of opening the box, another fascinating aspect of this franchise is not only what we've seen in the films, but its marketing campaign outside of it. This has got to be one of the most interesting and complex marketing campaigns for a franchise. I don't mean like just each independent film. I mean the franchise as a whole. You have stuff that goes as deep as, you know, encrypted web pages that utilize certain passcodes and information so that you can access more and more information about the films. And you, Chad, you're, like I said, the resident marketing guru. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's brilliant. I think that they were a lot smarter than we thought they were when they made the first one, because they have all of this, you know, all of the tie-in websites and augmented reality and the video game stuff and all that kind of stuff that they tie in. And the thing that's really intelligent about it is that a lot of that content has connections to other like separate content, but not to the main thrust of the storyline of the movies.
Yeah.
It's like the, it's as if you were writing a canonized set of novellas that tie into or a graphic novel series or something where
Jorge,
it's working kind of novella, to enhance and build out the world of the story of this Cloverfield verse. But the format is entirely different than what we're used to seeing. And when you do usually see like tie-in web pages or augmented reality campaigns or whatever, it's usually very specific to the movie and isn't meant to connect to the other movies or the other pieces of additional content. I think it's really smart that they at least give the impression that as creators, whoever they all are, because JJ doesn't have enough time to be the only one doing this. So whoever the thought leaders are on the creative team, they have a much bigger, broader picture of what this universe has in store than any of us likely ever will. So it does give that impression of a puppet master, I think.
And I think one of the great things that this marketing campaign does is what we had mentioned earlier in terms of how invested are you as a fan. This really delivers on those people who truly want to be invested over and above to know as much as you can. It's almost as if the well is not they haven't hit the bottom yet in terms of if they want to jump in, they can, because there's plenty of information out there for people to dive into and look up. We just happened to be looking at a video that tied all the information that has been happening in all three films and references a lot of the outside information, such as the company website of the drilling company, the Japanese drilling company that may have been the cause of a lot of this, Tagaratu, which happens to have a presence in most of J.J. Abrams' outside work.
Yeah, it's an Easter egg at the very least.
Mm-hmm. And including the part where Spencer was talking about there was something that fell down in the first film at the very end.
Oh, yeah, the satellite.
It's actually a satellite that was owned by Tagaratu, and the all the way from slushies to gas stations.
Slushos.
Get your slushos slushies.
Spencer knows this.
Right? Do you want to go ahead and take
it? No. You're doing a great job. There was an Easter egg for a slusho in the beginning of this movie.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that this film has to unveil, even to the point to where you're like looking up Twitter handles. There's a Twitter handle for the individual in the interview that Chad had mentioned in the third film, listed as paradox_is_real. That's an actual Twitter handle.
I forgot to look that up. I was looking at that. I was like, I need to look that up. And then I forgot.
Well, I was looking it up in the moment we were watching. And it's actually a real Twitter handle, but they haven't tweeted anything yet. Mm. But there's this film franchise goes so deep into like having hidden videos and hidden messages that people who have the time and are willing to put in the effort will find and get some kind of satisfaction out of it.
Well, and quite frankly, I mean, they could do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of universe where now you've got the laws of physics are being, you know, bent and mm-hmm. twisted. You know, I mean, your example, Spencer, of the guy who loses his arm in a battle literally with the wall. The wall, like, eats his arm, essentially, but not like it's a monster. Like, his arm just, like, gets magnetically sucked in almost, mm-hmm. and then suddenly they pull him out, and the rest of the arm isn't with him. And then the rest of the arm is somewhere else on the station and starts crawling around on its own. You know, like, there are things, or the sudden magnetism of certain objects, you know, later on when they're trying to escape the station, and suddenly everything metal is sticking to one wall out of nowhere. You know, they change one thing about the environment, and something seemingly unrelated then starts to also change, because they're in the zone of the paradox, if you will. But I mean, if they wanted to, they could bring back other people from the other films in new capacities, because now you're on a different version of Earth,
yeah.
where that person didn't go down into a bunker, or that person didn't die on a bridge, or, you know, didn't explode for whatever worms or whatever, like, whatever's going on. You know, so there are literally any possibility
yeah.
is open to them. You rarely see that in a mainstream movie franchise property.
Well, and that kind of leads to, Spencer, you have this perplexed look on your face, and I just want to give you an opportunity to...
I'm trying to not slow down the podcast with me piecing together bits of this movie that were, like, weird for me, because the thing with the worms just gushing out of the guy, that was odd.
Well, here's the thing to note.
To say the least, yeah.
Here's a very interesting thing to note. The worms that came out of him
uh-huh.
were substantially smaller than the worms that they had in that container at the beginning of the film. So, you have to ask yourself, number one, where did those worms come from? And number two, where did the worms in that container go to?
Now, my question is, why is this one guy the receptacle for everything that goes missing in the station?
That's true, because the worms are not the only thing.
Like, so much.
That they find in him.
Like, they just, like, check the body cavity. Maybe your lost watch is in there. It was weird.
I have to say, one of the shining points of this third film, Chris O'Dowd having a conversation with his detached arm.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that arm, by the way. I actually really liked him a lot.
You like the arm? Or
no.
Let's talk about the arm. I really liked him. He gave one of the best performances of the film.
He should get an Oscar. He's just really good.
Okay, I'm willing to go with, okay, the paradox makes, like, the arm work. What I don't get is, how did the arm know something the man did not? That's the confusing thing.
Well, you're assuming that the arm is from this current universe.
Yes, that's the thing. It was a different version of him's arm. The arm of a different version of him. Sorry, that didn't come out very well. Bad English.
Okay, but that still raises the question, what the heck happened in some other universe? It was like, oh yeah, that box is stored in that guy.
Yeah, no, that's a valid concern, and we might not ever know the answer.
Well, and you have to ask yourself, too, who is controlling the arm?
Probably.
Under what power is this arm operating?
Another version of him, I would assume.
Well, you have to also remember, that universe's space station went down in flames into the ocean.
Yeah.
It crashed.
Yeah, but there's more universes out there.
It's just a giant hodgepodge. Also, before we wrap things up, I do have to also point out one of the most intense scenes I thought in the film, which is the water.
Oh,
the water scene that then sad.
With Zhang Ji.
That was sad. Yes, that then it was very sad, but there was something like an ethereal beauty to it as well in terms of how that scene wraps up. And you're like, wow, that was fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fast. I would complain, but paradox, right. I guess.
No, I think that actually might be according to the laws of space in terms of, like, there's
temperature in space. No, heat, but, like, that seems incredibly rapid. Plus, it's like,
it's weird.
It's near bulkheads, though. There's still ambient temperature.
No, there was like a there was a door that swung open.
Yes, but you're still next to the rest of the space station.
I don't know, but
It was oddly, terrifyingly beautiful.
Yes.
Truth. There you go.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and here's
all right.
Here's one thing, one last thing to note too, and we still have another film that's debuting in October of this year.
Mm-hmm. Overlord.
Overlord. And the so I know you've both been confused already so far, but here's the synopsis of what this film is going to
be. Yeah, this one's going to be rough.
Nonsense.
On the eve of D-Day, American paratroopers are dropped behind enemy lines to carry out a mission crucial to the invasion's success. But as they approach their target, they begin to realize there is more going on in this Nazi-occupied village than a simple military operation. They find themselves fighting against supernatural forces, part of a Nazi experiment. So, we're going back in time, boys. And not just back in time like 10 years ago. This film's going back like 60, 70 years. And this is going to be... this is ultimately going to show how much of a ripple the events of Cloverfield Paradox have an effect on the Universal timeline altogether.
Sure.
So,
although I have to say, I cannot wait for that movie because... There are some grounds for connecting it legitimately to things that some members of the Nazi Party did actually try. Like, they were absolutely scouring the earth for relics and all kinds of odd
materials. I learned that one in Hellboy.
And all of that. So there's it'll be interesting to see what obviously they make up for the world of the story versus like what things they draw from the real actions of members of the Nazi party and military group. Like what do they connect from actual history to then the more fantastical elements? I think that'll be pretty fascinating.
What actual like incredible facts actually are presented in this film that
right.
could be like some kind of ostentatious...
Because there were gruesome experimentation things happening, and there were odd mystical like search patterns and whole like divisions of the army that were in places that they should not have been looking for things.
Yeah.
Like it was weird. It was weird, y'all.
It was weird, y'all. So, wrapping this all up, Spencer, we're going to start with you. Does this franchise pass or fail? And how many monocles would you give it thus far? Of course, we know we still have the fourth film to come up in October. But as it stands currently, how do you feel? And we're talking about as a franchise.
Yeah, I heard
whole.
That. Because I'd rate different movies differently.
I know, but we're talking.
That's a hard question.
We're talking together. Do you want me to go first? I'll go first.
No. Okay. You already called me.
You know what? I'm calling you out.
Okay. All right. So, yes, franchise does pass for me because, you know, for the most part, you know, minus some like weird physics in the last movie that we've just seen, you know, it holds together pretty well.
And Scooby-Doo in the wall.
Terrible.
So it passes for me, and I will give it 4 out of 5.
There you go. Chad?
I would also say it passes for me. It's compelling. It's different. I think it's really cool that people didn't realize, possibly including the filmmakers for the first one, but definitely audiences didn't realize that it was the start of a franchise. Like Spencer said earlier, it didn't even have a name for most of its buildup before it came out.
That's right.
So I think that in terms of, for the sake of things that they've done outside of the cinema, the tie-in elements and the additional time and effort and thought that's been put into it.
Yeah.
Also the name Gugu Mbatha-Raw. I would give it probably 4.25 maybe.
Okay.
I think it's inventive.
4.25 out of 5. Well, the film definitely passes for me. I like I said, I was looking for the next great science fiction, original science fiction piece that would, you know, be present in this decade as opposed to ones that we've had in the 70s and 80s and so forth. And I think this one really stands out in the 2000s in this era of movie making that, you know, this one's going to be talked about for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And
most definitely.
And so it passes for me. In terms of monocles, I'm going to give it 4.5 because I really like where it's going. I really love how it's being inventive, how it's creating new roads that haven't been really transgressed before in terms of not only how the film storyline goes, but how the outside storyline intertwines with everything else. And, I mean, who knows? J.J. Abrams may very well bring, you know, Jennifer Garner back to do an Alias, you know little cameo.
Sidney Bristow. That's all we need.
You know, with the kids from Super 8 and all this other kind of stuff. And who knows? Star Trek, Star Wars universe.
It's all connected.
So, I mean, I'm excited for what the possibilities are. And little key thing. Yes, the film's called Overlord. But much like how this film was called God Particle, and it changed the Cloverfield paradox, I'm interested in also seeing. Obviously, we won't find out till like the week before the movie comes out, or it may even drop
tomorrow. It's going to be out tomorrow. Watch Netflix.
It's going to come out, and someday in like September, and they're going to start promoting it in October. Like, oh yeah, you should have seen it. It dropped like last month. So, but who knows?
You know it. It's going to be Cloverlord.
Cloverlord.
Also, have we had an explanation of where the word Cloverfield even comes from?
That was the name of the project. Cloverfield Project.
Oh, right, the project, okay. But we don't know exactly what that project did yet.
Which, who knows, that might find an origin in Overlord.
Cloverlord might tell us.
Cloverlord. Mm. So, yeah, but let us know what you think. Do you enjoy the Cloverfield franchise, or do you think it's stupid and you just really are anti-everything great? Let us know on our Facebook page at facebook.com/philosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. A couple upcoming weekend releases we want to let you know of is you got Game Night debuting this Friday, as well as Annihilation. So if you get a chance, check out those films. Let us know what you think, and we can't wait to hear your thoughts. This was an awesome conversation. I enjoy talking about it because Cloverfield just seems to be a very unique and, you know, special franchise that honestly is going to become a template for what other people begin to do, quite possibly in the next year or two.
Yeah, good point.
So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Also known as Scooby-Doo. Class dismissed.